Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
Welcome to EIR Talks. It's Monday, August 20th, 2001. This is Tony Papert. Today we're going to watch Lyndon LaRouche answer questions from a August 2nd Mexico City teleconference sponsored by the Mexican Society of Public Accountants in the public interest. First, a few words on the Mideast crisis. It's important to understand that this is not a question between Israelis and Arabs or Palestinians. The force for war comes from outside the region itself. It comes from a faction of so-called geopoliticians here in the United States and in Britain, epitomized by Zbigniew Brzezinski and his student Samuel Huntington. It was Samuel Huntington who openly called in his book of that title for a clash of civilizations, which meant religious warfare between the so-called West and Islam or Muslims. Brzezinski referred to the same thing as the Ark of Crisis. And in fact, it was under Brzezinski, as National Security Advisor to then-President Carter, that the first important Islamic terrorist capability was built up by the United States and Britain in its weapons, its training, its recruitment, its indoctrination. And if you look at the actual Islamic terrorists, when they're captured around the world, they go back to that Brzezinski Afghanistan-centered operation. Another element of the religious warfare aspect, which is being deliberately fostered, is the attempt at provocations, for instance, most recently, July 29th, on the site called by Jews Temple Mount and by Muslims El Haram al-Sharif, or the Dome of the Rock, not only a sacred site to Jews, but the second holiest site in Islam. The attempt is to use clashes at this site or involving this site, as I say, to trigger religious warfare, which would not stop, and under these circumstances, it would not stop at the borders of Israel or Palestine or the occupied territories or even the Middle East as such. A key, again, to look at this is, what is the constituency for this war policy here in the United States? It's not so much the Sharon policy, he's not very important to it, but it's the policy of the Israeli Defense Forces and the geopolitical faction of which I spoke. The most important constituency, the ones who are in there daily lobbying Bush and the administration to support these war plans, is a group of the American so-called evangelicals, or televangelicals, of the like of Pat Robertson, who view religious warfare at the Dome of the Rock or Temple Mount as a requirement for Armageddon, the rapture, the end times. May seem unbelievable, but I think you've seen that it's actually true. That is the constituency which so far, to a point, has prevented this administration from doing anything to stop a slide toward war going outward from the Middle East into other parts of Asia. Now, over the past week, there's been a ray of hope in the situation. Lyndon LaRouche, who is a candidate for the Democratic presidential nomination for the year 2004, issued last Monday, August 13th, another appeal on the Mideast situation, this one called President Bush Must Change His Mind Quickly. He pointed out in that while it's true that during his approximately 7 months in office, President Bush has discredited himself quite thoroughly, still, the Congress, both Democratic and Republican, has discredited itself more fully. Intrinsic to the powers of the U.S. presidency is the ability, in the crisis like this one, to become the strong call of leadership which shows the way out. And if Bush would exercise that leadership relative to the Middle East by putting a sudden end to the preparations for all-out warfare in Israel. That form of leadership would also be usable in the gathering economic crisis as the U.S. slides deeper into depression. Now, that call of LaRouche was answered that same week by cooperation between President Bush and Russia's President Putin for the first time to begin to bring the situation under control. After a discussion between the U.S. Department of State and the Russian Foreign Ministry, Bush and Putin spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Sharon on successive days. And the result has been thus far that Israeli troops and armor have been halted outside Bethlehem and another Palestinian city, which they were prepared to invade last week. And now, LaRouche before the National Association of Public Accountants in the Public Interest, August 2nd, Mexico City.
The world system is disintegrating, according to your remarks, but the impression that I have from looking at this is that over the last 15 to 20 years, what there has been more integration, and what there has been is that it has worked, but for the benefit of the great powers, not for us, but it has worked for a few nations. You say Bretton Woods worked well, certainly better than today. I would say that the same problem existed with Bretton Woods then. It worked for some people, but not for all, some countries, but not all. With regard to the 60s and the break that occurred there through Nixon's policies and others, I agree. Part of it was an increase of the tariff, a U.S. protectionist tariff of 10%, and also the break between the dollar and gold that Nixon implemented. But the other big questions that I want to raise are the following. Number one, this entire period constituted a free ride for the United States, that the United States was able to simultaneously run its war in Vietnam and launch the Great Society program, and this led to a great inflationary expansion, which ended up hurting us all in every parts of the world. The second point are the ideological changes, which you did refer to and which I agree with, of the introduction of von Hayek and similar policies, generally implemented under the Reagan-Thatcher duo. And what this led to was a global idolatry of the market, the loss of the state role in producing and bringing about the general welfare of populations, and this has created today's mess. But I understand that you are proposing a return to the gold standard or a gold exchange standard and protectionism, but let's not forget that this is what actually created the Second World War and what was behind it. You say the United States economy is collapsing, and eventually it probably will. And of course, if you predict this every year, sooner or later you'll be right. It's not altogether clear if the current recession is actually going to lead into this, or if we are rather witnessing the great long-term Kondratiev cycles that are bringing about these changes. So will things really work? Will they be resolved with gold and with protectionism? Will we be able to have a world system which will impose fiscal responsibility on all nations? Do the conditions for this exist to especially impose this on the big governments and the big corporations that today dominate the world?
Well, this, you've posed some very interesting questions because they cover a large area, some points of agreement, some points of disagreement. But let me go to what the crucial thing is right now. As we sit here, I don't know what the status is at this moment. We're headed for the rather immediate outbreak of what will become a generalized religious war throughout Eurasia, either launched by Sharon, the present dictator of Israel, or by his successors, who may replace him and be more wild than he is, which I've written about number of things, and I've managed to stir up some concern in my own U.S. government and elsewhere on this, and they have more recently taken better action, though I don't think an adequate one yet, to try to bring Sharon under control. Because if this thing happens, you will have not a new Israeli-Arab war. You will have a religious war in which Israel would probably be driven to the point under the impetus of this policy of attacking not only Lebanon, Syria, invading Jordan, driving the Palestinians into Jordan, destabilizing Jordan, war with Iran, and so forth and so on. Such a war pivoted upon the religious issue of the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, which is a holy place for all Islam, is the kind of detonator which can set off throughout Eurasia a generalized religious war. And it is such religious wars, as we know from the history of Europe between 1511 and 1648, which threatened to bring on dark ages for humanity. So that's the general situation. Now, but behind that goes directly to what you're saying. Why should that be happening in the Middle East now? It is not, to my knowledge, it is not the Israelis or the Arabs who are responsible for this conflict. Yes, there may be factors, people who act like puppets on a string, witting or unwitting, who may be contributing directly, immediately on the scene to the conflict. But they are not the cause. The cause lies elsewhere. When you say the gold exchange system led to World War II, that's not true. Something else did. When the United States defeated the Confederacy and told the French to get out of Mexico in 1865 after defeating the Confederacy, at that point, the United States had emerged as the most powerful single economy on this planet. We had the highest level of technology. We didn't have the most advanced science, but the highest level of technology. We were vigorously growing. We had been unleashed by being freed from the burden of the Confederacy and slavery. At that point, forces in Europe recoiled. The British in particular. They saw the United States immediately in 1876, 1877. Russia, Japan, Germany, and other countries adopted the American policy, the so-called Friedrich List or Henry C. Carey policy, the American system policy of Lincoln. It was adopted by Bismarck's order in 1973 in Germany. It was adopted by the Tsar Alexander II in Russia through Mendeleev, who built the Trans-Siberian Railroad, who was at Philadelphia for that convention in 1876. It was adopted by Japan, which transformed itself under the direct influence of Henry C. Carey from a feudal nation into an industrial nation. As a result of this, the ideas of transcontinental railway systems, like those of the United States, would also, as the ideas of Friedrich List, were spread throughout Europe. We had the Trans-Siberian Railroad. We had the proposals to build railroads in cooperation, cooperating throughout all of Eurasia. We had the emergence at the end of the century of Sun Yat-sen, an American-sponsored leader who sought to create a new China. And British hated it all. So Edward VII, while still Prince of Wales, organized a series of alliances and operations under the aegis of what was called geopolitics, to put these allied nations, then cooperating up until 1898, France, Germany, Russia, Japan, and others, to bring them, to separate them from each other, who had been cooperating under the influence of the American system, the American success of Lincoln. And that is why the British, and the British alone, organized World War I. They got the French into the Entente Cordiale, which is sort of an obscene embrace. They played the Balkan Wars to get other things going, as in the in Russia. They took the reactionary group in Russia against Alexander II's tradition. They moved it for an attack on Germany in alliance with France and England. And that's how World War I was organized. Then again, we had World War II. At that point, the British planned with the French to turn Hitler loose in Germany, to use Hitler-led Germany for an attack on Russia. After which, when Hitler was embedded in the Russian wars, the French and British planned to attack Germany's rear end and destroy it. At that point, they intended up until about 1936 to keep the United States out of the war. And it was the British who organized the American isolationist movement of the 1930s, is to keep the United States out of the future war in Europe, which the British had planned. Yeah? But then the British discovered that Hitler and Stalin were negotiating. And they were negotiating to prevent a war between the Soviet Union and Germany until after Germany had defeated the Allied British and French forces. At that time, about 1936, the British changed their mind. They dumped Edward VIII, who had been the pro-Hitler king of England. And they got this woman, Mrs. Windsor, and got her to create an embarrassment, a scandal, and got him out of there. And then the United States was then brought in as a prospective ally of Britain and France for the war against Nazi Germany. That's how the war got started. Again, the same issue, geopolitics. Today, we face a situation in which the breakdown of the Bretton Woods system, of the IMF system, has brought about a condition under which India, China, Japan, Korea, Southeast Asia, Russia, Iran, and other countries, including to a significant degree France, Germany, and Italy, are seeking to establish a new unit of cooperation in Eurasia for building a new monetary system, a new financial system, a new economic system to replace the bankrupt Anglo-American system. There are certain forces in the United States and Britain, not all of them, who therefore say, let's use geopolitics. If you want to hear somebody say that, listen to Zbigniew Brzezinski, the man who was people in Mexico should be familiar with from the Carter administration, what he did to Mexico during that period. Brzezinski is saying we must have geopolitical wars, including religious wars, in Eurasia, and Brzezinski is one of the pushers or the architects or the voices for those forces which are pushing the idea of a Middle East war. Now, I've been dealing with this with various governments through my friends and channels and saying, look, let's not believe the myths. Let's tell the truth for a change. The danger is a geopolitically caused Middle East war, which can spread as a religious war to put this planet up in flames at a time we need some peace and need some reconstruction. That's the issue, the same issue today. Now, here's what the problem is. The idea of the United Yankee imperialism is a very popular term, and we've had a good dose of it in the form of Teddy Roosevelt. You had a dose of it in one of the worst forms of it in that great Democratic pro-racist Woodrow Wilson, the man who organized the Ku Klux Klan again as a revival from the White House. A bad kind of Democrat, you know. So, yes, there is justification for anger against certain forces in the United States, especially around the New York bankers and around those who maintain the Southern tradition, like Henry Kissinger's tradition, the tradition of William Yandell Elliott, who trained Kissinger at Harvard, who was a racist from Tennessee, a member of the Nashville Agrarians, a real racist pro-Confederacy organization. You have those forces in the history of the hemisphere, especially Mexico. We have the filibusters. Where'd they come from? They came from Teddy Roosevelt's uncle, who organized the filibustering in Cuba, into Mexico and elsewhere. These Confederates were the allies of the Maximilian operation in Mexico. The Confederacy was an ally of Maximilian and of what the French occupation of Mexico. So, yes, we have these things in the United States. We have them still. Nixon was part of it. He represented it. Carter represented that. George Bush, the senior, represented that. The son, if he knows what he represents implicitly through his associations, represents that same Southern combination, the same New York Southern tradition combination. But the United States is not inherently an imperial power by our very nature. We have an American Tory tradition, which are these guys I don't like and you don't like either. And we should probably get together and make sure that they don't do what they did in the past anymore. But we also have an American intellectual tradition, which has always been intellectually allied with the idea of the independence of Mexico, as John Quincy Adams was and as Abraham Lincoln was. And we have that too. The problem here is that the United States did not benefit at all from what happened in the past period. The United States has been a partner, especially since Nixon's election, has been a partner of a certain faction in Britain in doing what became conspicuous in 1989-1990. With the collapse of the Soviet Union, or the Soviet system, a certain Anglo-American force, allied with Mitterrand of France, decided they were going to do two things. They were going to keep the Russians down and keep the Germans down and the Russians up. And during in that policy, which was conducted from 1990 on to the present, the Anglo-American interests have looted Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, Central Asia, Poland, Slovakia, Czechia, Hungary, and so forth, and have looted it for the greater wealth and glory of U.S. and British interests. They have they control the IMF and use the IMF as a means of looting countries. What you have today is the United States has been bankrupt for a long time, but why hasn't the United States gone belly up? The United States has not gone belly up because the United States had political power to steal. We use the IMF and other institutions as a way of stealing. We went to Russia. We dictated terms. We looted. We stole. We stole from Mexico. We stole from South America. We stole from Japan. We forced the Japanese to print money to bail out the U.S. dollar. And the Japanese banking system is bankrupt as a result of printing money to try to bail out the U.S. dollar. The euro was looted to bail out the U.S. dollar. Russia was looted. South Asia was being looted. What was done to Indonesia was a crime. So it was not the economic system which looted for the United States. The United States rather looted the world in the same way that the Roman Empire looted, that the British Empire looted, and that the Venetians used to loot. The same kind of system. So that the political power of the Anglo-American powers as a combination. An Anglo-American power which is typified in the United States by the Nixon tradition of the alliance of the Northern bankers with the Southern races. That combination. This has had the power. And what has happened over the past period was a destruction of the system which built up the world economy. Sure, there were injustices. I'm well aware of the injustices that were done in Mexico and South America during the 1950s and 1960s. But sure, it was done. Sure, there were New York interests. I can name them. Many of you can name them. In each country, who from New York and elsewhere had the privilege of looting, have looting rights in these countries. That was done. But overall, there was an increase in the productive power of labor and an increase in the overall welfare of these countries, while they were being looted. So the question here has to be divided between the question of interests and systems. That is, you have an economic system, one works, the other doesn't. You have an interest, which in whatever system it's a part of, may loot or may be beneficial. That's the irony of the thing. As far as a crisis, I can assure you the crisis is on. Look at the figures. We've published the figures in EIR and other sources. We publish them in our briefing more or less daily or several times a week. The latest statistics. The statistics on the situation. This is not merely a depression. The depression is already here. The system is hopelessly bankrupt. It's not something that might happen. It's had to happen. This is not episodic. This is finished. It's dead. I know the propaganda, the approved propaganda in the press is to the contrary. But I can assure you and everybody I know, I talk with, and I work with in every part of the world who I respect in these matters, and not always I don't always agree with, but I respect them, agree. This thing is finished, and it's a longer story, but the system symptoms are all there. It's finished, and the problem has to be put down to these two things. What are the interests in the world? What are the national interests? What are the systemic interests? And what are the problems? And I tell you today, this world could get along fairly well if it was not dominated by that Anglo-American combination which is behind the present monetary system. We probably would get along fairly well. We might have our arguments and disagreements, but we would get along and we would prosper. And that's what I think we have to look for. That's what we have to do.
This is the question. it is the next question that's asked. I'd like to congratulate you. It's always a pleasure and very interesting to hear what you have to say or to read your remarks, but I must admit I feel a certain ambivalence because we appreciate, on the one hand, to hear the words of a great economic thinker who has launched a crusade internationally for justice. On the other hand, we are somewhat discouraged because your results are not what they should be. The response is negative, or it's sometimes Pyrrhic victories. Beginning with the United States itself, which is the most democratic country, supposedly, they have also been captured by these policies. There, too, wages are dropping, the standard of living is falling, security is a problem, and so forth. So that's a concern of mine. I have two concrete questions. Given the powers that are now hegemonic and given their repressive capabilities, what are the best actions that could be taken by countries such as Mexico, which, as you know, are somewhat dependent, and as are other countries, to resolve these problems? And furthermore, you seem to presuppose that these governments in such countries agree to take such action, and as you know, that's not necessarily the case. So that's the first question. The second question is, after the great failure of the Bretton Woods system that we now see and the problems that we solve and that we are trying to resolve, I am interested in knowing what the role of the Trilateral Commission is in particular in these matters.
Okay. Well, the smaller powers have no independent ability to change the world system. Otherwise, what has happened to countries could not have happened. The case of Mexico, that was 1982, for example. Mexico was trying to pursue an independent line under President López Portillo, who had enthusiastic support from leading circles of his countrymen at that time. And he had temporarily support from the government of Argentina and Brazil. But then Kissinger and their circles then intervened heavily, Brazil and Argentina, with London's intervention also, to cause the governments of Argentina and Brazil to desert their firm promises to President López Portillo. Mexico was left isolated. Kissinger was all over the place. And since that time, Mexico has never been able to exert the kind of independence which it had exerted earlier. That's reality. It's the Mexico case. I could go through many other parts of the world, the same kind of thing.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
So therefore, what is needed is essentially an alliance among a group of people who represent, respectively, sovereign nation states. Now, in the case of Russia, for example, there are many questions about what the Putin administration in Russia represents. There is a certain ambivalence in the policy and economic policy initiatives of the Putin government. But I have a different view of this matter. And I've watched certain things. The agreement between the president of China and Russia recently, following the agreement at Shanghai on the Shanghai Cooperation Council, that is a positive development. New agreements between India and China new attempts at peace between Pakistan and India. Important developments now going on in Southeast Asia involving Malaysia and other countries. The important developments in Japan, which may erupt in a very shocking way very soon. Important developments still going on in Korea. The role of Iran, under the leadership of President Khatami, who is a very unusual, important leader to watch. He's a very strong intellectual figure, a very deep and good man in many ways. Then also what's coming with our friends in Italy. There are a great number of parliamentarians in Italy. Italy may not have great power, but you find there are more parliamentarians in Italy who have committed themselves to justice, debt relief for the most impoverished countries, for a new Bretton Woods system, and so forth, than any other country on this planet. You have people in Europe, other parts of Europe, who think in a similar way. So that we have, around the world, a very significant accretion of power represented by a number of sovereign countries who are coming together around ideas. And in my view, as you know, ideas are the most important things. Agreements aren't worth much. Ideas are worth everything. That is, good ideas. Because when people agree on a principle, then their actions governed by that principle will tend to be beneficial. And I find in Russia, in particular, as with my relations with some of the academicians over there on economics and so forth, they're very serious, and they're moving in very positive directions. If some of these things come together, then we're going to have a new combination. In the case of the Bush administration, for example, now, the Bush administration, I've characterized quite fairly, is an international disaster for the United States, that is the current one, and for other countries as well. But, you know, an inaugurated president of the United States under the U.S. Constitution and our system comes under tremendous pressures. And sometimes the man in the office, even an unlikely occupant of that office, may respond in an unexpected but useful way to a crisis. You have a situation where everything that poor George Bush is trying to do is going to fail. Everything he came into office to do is going to fail. It's going to be a disaster. But is he going to sit there with nothing but one disaster after another? Is he not going to start to listen to people saying to Mr. President, maybe we should think about this, maybe we should think about that? Bush at first was inclined to give Sharon a clear way to go ahead with war. Now he's not so sure. Yes, he has these religious fanatics, these Protestant fanatics in the United States, who are the main force backing the idea of religious war in the Middle East. They are an important part of Bush's base. But Bush has changed on this issue. There are important developments. We've seen a change in the Senate in the United States. The change was a good one, sometimes for me disappointing. Daschle has disappointed me greatly of late. But nonetheless, these changes are occurring. More changes will occur. Europe is going to change. When you see this leading Swiss newspaper, the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, saying that the only solution for Argentina is a debt moratorium, that's the voice of the Swiss bankers. And you look around Europe among intelligent people in leading positions in England, in France, Germany, and elsewhere, think the same thing. So the mood is swinging away from the IMF system and swinging in the direction of new ideas. Because people in positions of power, particularly if they're in relatively powerful nations or combinations of nations, tend to see opportunities more quickly than people in governments which feel themselves on the bottom of the heap in terms of political influence. My concern here is that Mexico should realize that it is not at the bottom of the heap. It may appear to be in some respects, but it's not at the bottom of the heap. Mexico is an important country. In population, one of the largest in South and Central America. Very important in respect to the United States. The welfare of Mexico is a very important concern, security concern, for the United States. Mexico cannot be ignored. And how the United States deals with Mexico will determine largely how the rest of the hemisphere looks at the United States. and so forth and so on. So the situation is not a hopeless one. I would suggest that when ideas collapse, when the tyrants collapse, then things can happen. And we must keep our hopes, our expectations up, but clear-headedly, and proceed confidently. You know, sometimes it's like the great discoverer. In the case of Columbus' discovery of the Americas, which is a rediscovery, but Columbus was not stumbling across the Atlantic. Columbus knew what he was doing, because Columbus was operating on the basis of a letter which was written by a friend of Cardinal Nicholas of Cusa, who the letter was found in Portugal, and one of Cusa's friends in Portugal made it accessible to Columbus, who was at that point a Portuguese captain. Columbus then entered in the 1580s in the correspondence with this Toscanelli, the geometer, read Toscanelli's map of the world, discussed the problems with Toscanelli. Columbus knew about the nature of ocean currents, that is, he knew about what we call today the Coriolis forces in ocean currents, and knew by calculations that there must be, that Toscanelli must be right, there must be land at a certain distance across the Atlantic. And Toscanelli, Columbus carried a route which was an ancient route, probably traveled by the fabled Ulysses, who probably went through the Pillars of Hercules to the Caribbean in the same way that Columbus did, across the same current that Columbus used to get to what we call Santo Domingo. So sometimes, like Columbus, or like other great discoverers, you have to proceed from scientific certainty rather than trend lines. And you have to proceed with optimism based on scientific certainty, knowing that you have the ability to make come true what you believe is possible. And all I can hold out to Mexico today is I know these things are ripe, I know these things are possible, and what is needed is to encourage people to see that possibility and to seize it and to move ahead to make the possible become the actual.
Very good. Marivilla Carrasco has just summarized a large number of written questions that have been handed in, which I will review briefly for you. The point is, if you have any closing remarks to make in regard to these questions asked, that would be very useful, but these would be the closing remarks. One of the sets of questions, there's three sets of questions. One, with regard to the crisis, is this systemic, is this conjunctural, how can you answer these questions, how do you know what's what? And particularly, if it is in fact systemic, what happens if the United States does not go along? What can a country like Mexico do if the United States does not decide to participate? The second range of questions have to do with Mexico proper, and questions about the Mexican banking system. Is the Mexican banking system as bad as the global bankrupt system you've described? How can we establish a new credit generation system? How could we reactivate it? And what is the connection, the conveyor belt between this banking system and infrastructure, and in particular, people? How does this affect people?
Okay. Well, thank you all very much, first of all. We've had some difficulties, technical difficulties, in doing things the way they were planned, but I think we can forgive whatever happened. These things do happen. All right. Anyway. Now, first of all, let me just probably the most important thing is to respond to the list of three types of questions as the closing remarks. First of all, this is a systemic crisis. But that means, for example, look at the model of a Euclidean geometry, a classroom geometry, in which the students are told to believe on faith certain definitions, certain axioms, and also certain postulates. They are then told by deduction to arrive at theorems which will all be consistent with those definitions, axioms, and postulates. That is the general idea of a system. Now, it's not a very good system because it doesn't correspond to physical reality, but it's what we generally mean by use of the term system. as an intellectual system. And when we say a systemic failure, we mean that the set of definitions, axioms, and postulates, or the equivalent, on which a society or some function or company, for example, is operating, is doomed because it has the wrong set of definitions, axioms, and postulates, or the wrong method, such as a deductive method may be the wrong method. So the system is collapsing not because it has a cyclical crisis or so-called conjunctural crisis, not that at all. We've had those before. This is a genuine global breakdown crisis in which the assumptions of free trade, the assumptions of ending the modern nation state in favor of globalization, of free trade, and that sort of thing, NAFTA, for example, assumptions of no more technological progress, or the lunatic assumption that of information theory and systems analysis. These kinds of new assumptions, which were introduced in part in the post-war period or sometimes earlier, but which became a system over the period from about the middle of the 1960s, these ideas together represent a system that was doomed. Now, the problem is this. An economic system, a modern economic system in particular, is based on long-term capital improvements. And I'm talking about not monetary improvements, but physical improvements, like basic economic infrastructure, transportation systems, irrigation systems, water management systems, school systems, educational systems, investment in industries, whole types of industries, training of a labor force in certain skills. These are all capital. For example, it takes 25 years to bring a newborn infant into full adult maturity. That is, as a modern adult with modern skills, modern professional competence. So that's an investment. If you make the wrong mistakes, starting from birth with children, you may pay the penalty 25 years later. The same thing with if you don't maintain infrastructure. It wears out. If you don't replace it, an improvement, it collapses on you. So what's happened is over the past 35 years, a series of changes in the way policy has been made has depleted and looted the buildup of assets, human capital, physical capital, which we built up over the previous centuries. So that's what the problem is. We've come to the end of the system, and unless we change the definitions, axioms, postulates and method by which we operate will collapse. Whereas going back to 1945, 1964, the system then was based upon certain definitions, such as improvements in infrastructue, which continued in the United States until the late 1960s. We made a net improvement in investment in basic economic infrastructure, especially long-term. Investment in science, scientific progress, training engineers and scientists to utilize scientific and economic progress, increasing the stability of the family household with stable communities, with building families, with a family orientation in the household, this kind of thing, with the idea of classical education, classical entertainment. That is, forms which are rational, which are based on reason, which are inspirational in their effects. Classical music, classical art, classical literature, yeah? That sort of thing. So we build up a population which, in net effect, had actually an increased per capita capability in the United States, for example, over this period. The same thing was true, I believe, in Mexico. There was an increasing capability per capita in much of the population of Mexico and Mexico as a whole. Yes, the potential was aborted. Foreign pressures prevented the potential from being fully realized, but it was there. The same thing was true in Europe into the middle of the 1960s. It was a general improvement in recovery from the disastrous state of Europe at the end of the war. In the Soviet Union, there was similarly improvement, despite all the problems there, a net improvement in conditions from the end of the war to that period. So you had a system then which, with many imperfections in each case, worked. But the system we've had since the middle of the 1960s, especially since 1971 with the introduction of the floating exchange rate system, has not worked. And what we're seeing is the world cannot continue to survive unless we abandon this system. The system is what's killing us, and that's what I mean by systemic crisis. The Mexican banking system doesn't worry me, because if nothing is done to change the situation, it's going to collapse. So if a system dies, you don't really worry too much about the cause of death unless you have a new system to worry about and you don't want it to die the same way. The question of the Mexican banking system is how to save it. Because Mexico needs, I believe Mexico needs a national bank under these conditions. Without a national bank, I don't think adequate internal development is possible. But you need a network of private banks which have a close relationship to the savings practices of the population, which are close to local borrowers, local firms, local businesses, which are an integral part of the community. And they are a vehicle for assembling credit, administering it, for dispensing loans, managing the loans, as adjuncts of the national financial monetary system. And therefore, what you have to do with the Mexican banking system is save it by whatever reorganization measures are necessary to save it. As for the electricity and so forth, Mexico should, first of all, look, the United States does not really need Mexico's energy. We have an energy crisis in the United States, which is largely a result of Carter, President Jimmy Carter, and people since then haven't done too well with it. We have a shortage of energy. We used to have a well-regulated energy system in the United States. We destroyed it. We are now suffering as a result of that, plus wild-eyed speculation. Mexico never had an adequate energy system developed. There were attempts around Pemex to build it up. For example, during the earlier years of the presidency of President López Portillo, there were still plans which had been accumulated into his government to develop nuclear energy in Mexico. It was very sane, because nuclear energy is a high-density energy, and it's better to shift in the long run from the use of petroleum for burning for fuel to use petroleum as a chemical feedstock, and to shift to other types of energy which have higher energy flux density. For example, you would not want to desalinate, unless you had very cheap petroleum, with the use of petroleum. You would prefer to have a high flux density, like energy, efficient energy, or say a high temperature gas cooled reactor, or fusion energy if we had it available yet. So what Mexico needs is the development of its own internal energy system. It does not need the United States energy if the United States does what it should do. Yes, some Mexican oil can be sold to the United States. That's not the problem. The problem is to rebuild the Mexican overall energy infrastructure and energy production infrastructure and similar kinds of reforms. And as to fiscal reforms, essentially what's needed is a bankruptcy reorganization of the international system, and obviously we need a stable fiscal system in Mexico. But as was said by Dr. Willem Lautenbach, in Germany in 1931, at a meeting of the Friedrichsgesellschaft, where a proposal was made which would have prevented Hitler if it had been implemented. The proposal was that in case of a depression, you never go to fiscal austerity under conditions of depression. You do the opposite. What you do is you mobilize public credit to provide large-scale employment in useful forms of infrastructure, and use the infrastructure investment as a stimulus for industrial investment and the private sector generally, and recovery. So what's needed in Mexico is not an overdose of fiscal austerity. Mexico has already had too much fiscal austerity. It is fiscal austerity that often drives citizens of Mexico across the border of the United States in desperate seeking of employment, which is not available in Mexico. You look at the United States is collapsing as an importer of last resort from Mexico. If you look at the percentile of the total Mexican output and employment, which depends upon exports into the United States, and recognize that this is largely a result of too much fiscal austerity in Mexico. That is not enough investment in Mexican job creation. That is, we already have an overdose of it. What we need is fiscal responsibility in the sense of using resources, managing resources, to target benefits for the general welfare of the country. As to a cultural crisis, yes, we do have a cultural crisis. We have a global cultural crisis, not a Mexican cultural crisis. The question is, and this gets on an area of religion, and I'm not much for single-issue religionism, or that sort of thing, or the kind of stuff we have too much of in the United States. But nonetheless, there's a fundamental question, a question of a difference between man and the animal. And as an economist, particularly in my specialty in physical economy, this is crucial for me. It's a crucial point of economics. The essential difference between a man and a beast as a species is that no animal is capable of discovering and effectively utilizing a principle of universal physical principle. Only a human being, only the human mind can do that. This constitutes a fundamental difference between man and the beast. So we start in morality and culture from the question, what is the nature of man? Now, if we make a discovery of principle, and I often use the case of Archimedes' discoveries, because Archimedes is a nice figure to use for this. Archimedes was a great discoverer. If you read French, you can read French translations of his collected works, which are great fun. But Archimedes was killed in 1212 BC by Roman soldiers. A great mind, a great loss to humanity. But Archimedes made discoveries which a child in a school today can reenact. Discoveries of universal physical principles. That child, in that sense, is able to recapture the living thought of Archimedes' act of discovery and make that thought the child's own thought. Now, in a good educational system, in a good society, we don't exchange information. We exchange ideas, like the great scientific discoveries of Archimedes and others, which we try to impart to our children. For example, I presume in Mexico, any good school will teach the Cervantes to children as part of the educational program, especially I understand the second part two of Don Quixote is especially significant. And these great classical works of that type, or like the works of Rabelais in France, may not acceptable in Spanish, but they're acceptable in French. The great works of Rabelais, these are things which communicate ideas which have the same character as discoveries of scientific principles from one mind to the other. The child is able, through such great literary works and other classical works, to reach back to previous generations, to recapture the mind of some living person then who discovered an idea, and the child is able to reenact that discovery, like a child who studies Rembrandt, or a child who studies how to work like Leonardo da Vinci, or like a great musical composer. So that in a good culture, we celebrate that about us which makes us human, as distinct from animals. We celebrate our ability to replicate the greatest discoveries of science and art of mankind before us. We enjoy sharing those ideas with our friends and talk and work with our friends in the same way we would like to work with the great scientists or artists of the past. Then we have respect for one another. Because we have respect for what we are, human beings. And we realize that all human beings are really the same. They're born with the same potential. And they're equally potentially lovable, if they're decently educated and raised properly. And we look at nations, we realize that nations can best order their affairs if they're perfectly sovereign. But we don't look at the difference between our sovereign nation and another sovereign nation as some reason for hatred or conflict. We view that as an advantage, that if we can bring our affairs in order, and the other nation can bring its affairs in order, and we can work together, we can truly have a relationship across borders, which is a truly human relationship. To me, that is culture. What we have today, in my view, we have a culture of greed and a historical view. We have a culture based on a corrupt form of entertainment. And I think we're much more destroyed by our entertainment industry than anything else. Because we have forms of entertainment which are bestializing, which is something that an animal could better do than we. And we've lost sight of those aspects of human cultural relations which remind us that the person behind those eyes across the room is on the inside a member of a special species, the human species, exactly like us. And we care for them not only because they're like us in that respect, but we care for them because we know we're all going to die. And our ability to contribute the best that we have to give to future generations is really the meaning of our life. And that is what we've lost. And that, I think, is the essential cultural crisis.
You've been listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.